Last week, our exploration regarding seeing religions in 3D took us deeper into the consideration of what religions most often have in common. And so that's, we've sort of been in that space for a bit, I would say. And that kind of emphasis, which I hope would help us in a community like this to kind of back away from whatever religions we might be most familiar with in order to consider some of the overall shape of others and see how huge that common ground is. Being in that kind of a space, especially over some time, that can lead to what I'm going to say are incorrect assumptions. And that's, it's to judge assumptions. I realize that. Let me unpack it a little bit. You can agree or disagree, of course. But when we emphasize commonalities, I think we pretty naturally de-emphasize distinctives. We do have a, you know, we do have a kind of an either-or tendency, it seems like. And that might lead us to think that distinctives either don't matter or that we might simply be better off without them. I mean, isn't it the distinctives in terms of religion, isn't it the distinctives that cause all this inter-religion conflict? That perception that it's the distinctives that are at the root of religious conflicts often has for us, it's not just a not just because we might be inclined to either or, it often has a lived experience sort of basis. I heard an interview this past week with a singer that was completely new name to me, may not be to some of you. The person's performer name is Ethel Kane. Kane's an American artist. She grew up in Florida, in the South, in a very exclusivist expression of Christianity. And her departure from that forms a lot of the background for her debut album, which is called Preacher's Daughter. Her story is a complex mixture of happiness. She would say that in many ways she had a wonderful childhood and deep sort of surprising pain. And by surprising, I mean that she grew up in a community that so isolated the young that it wasn't until she was an adult and went away to school, because she also wasn't part of a public school system or any other public system, including friendship circles or community circles growing up. But when she left those circles, it wasn't until then that she realized how isolated she had been in her growing up and came to the understanding that that isolating of the young in that system was there so that those youngsters would adhere to that set of religious beliefs. It was all part of a commitment to keeping them inside that circle of belief. What I found most interesting in the interview was her talking about her choice regarding how to respond to those discoveries. And at one point in the interview, she talked about how all of that cutting her off from outside influences was an attempt to, her words, drag her toward Jesus, but how for her it had actually had the exact opposite effect. So when she finally had some experiences that helped her see how problematic that was, as she talks about it, she would say her first inclination was to run away, like to literally run away. And in the interview, she talked about fleeing to Portland, was her phrase, because Portland in the United States diagonally was as far geographically away as she could get from where she grew up in South Florida, like that, and still be on the, you know, mainland part of the continent. And she says she set out to do that. She had it out. And she said she got about an hour away from home, like on the road, and she realized, I can't do this. And the reason she says she couldn't do it is because she loved where she grew up. And if we left the story right there, we might come to all kinds of conclusions about the damage done to her in her growing up years, the impossibility or deep difficulty of her ever really being an adult with autonomy and freedom to choose and all those kinds of issues. And some of those themes contribute to the complexity of the image in her art. But it was what she said next in the story that really grabbed my attention on this point. She said that she learned that you can love where you're from and not love everything that happened there. And in the context of the interview, I understood that as both a literal geographic description of something that was real in her life and also a pretty lively metaphor for her lived experience. And this is an important idea when it comes to what we're exploring today. We can love where we're from and not love everything that happened there. Kane now lives in Alabama, which is, you know, still the American South, long ways from Portland, culturally and geographically. And she says that choice to stay in the general part of the world where she grew up and that she loves, and yet to also exercise choice and autonomy, has been much more healing than fleeing would. Interesting. One way to think about that story is as a narrative that touches on this matter of parsing the difference between distinctives and the context for those distinctives when it comes to thinking about religions in a wider context. So when it comes to our exploration of religions, seeing how much they have in common in ways that feel sort of common sense-ish, you know, you just kind of look at the data, if you will, that could lead us to think that we would be best off taking all religions as kind of one big lump. And one of the implications of that might be feeling as though rejecting any one part of the whole amounts to tossing the whole thing, kind of moving across the metaphorical continent of belief to just get as far away as we can from the hurt that we've experienced so we can start again on our own terms. And sometimes, of course, that's exactly what we might feel like we need to do. We need to just flee. We need to just get as far away as we can. And doing so, that, you know, that might be our path. That might be our way forward. That said, there might also be some other ways to think about this. And for some of us, they might offer other paths that turn out to be, for us as they have been for Ethel Cain, more healing than fleeing. If I talked a bit in these past weeks, I have talked a bit these past weeks about the work of William James, and particularly his enduring benchmark book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. In the last chapter of that book, James sums up much of what we looked at last week when we were talking about similarities, this notion that religions are most similar in the kinds of experiences of the sacred that are reported within them, the sorts of practices they encourage. We talked about how most religions, enduring religions, have something of worship and something of prayer in terms of their practices, and that they share a desired outcome. And this one often gets lost in, especially I think in the 20th century expressions of the dominant religions, notably Christianity in the West, but that the historic outcome, desired outcome of those religious practices has been human transformation in the direction of compassion, becoming more compassionate people. And James goes on to say that they are most different from one another. So those are the commonalities, but they are most different from one another in their beliefs and doctrines, what he calls their conceptualizations. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because beliefs and doctrines, which are the particularly religious shape given to concepts when they're influenced by religious teachings, are part of the religion that will be most affected by the cultural context in which they're formed. So they're bound to have stronger connections to the culture of their origin. And if the cultures are different from one another, so will the conceptualizations be. That sort of follows. So, for example, if we are part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, or that's where we grew up, that might be why we find images of things like Lamb of God in Christian doctrines that are built on Hebrew teachings in the culture of the Hebrew people. In the context, there were shepherds, culturally speaking. There was lots of sheep around. There were lambs around. And when it came to the practice of appeasing the deity with sacrifices, they got sacrificed. It's also why we continue to have the dove as a symbol of peace. It's part of that same cultural structure and so on, right? So that image becomes part of the shape that is given to doctrines dealing with Christian ideas like sin and forgiveness. It tracks along, at least for a while. We make cultures out of the stuff that we're surrounded by, and religions, if we think of them as cultural linguistic things, are also made out of the stuff that's surrounding them when they're being formed. And one of the results of that is that they are different from one another. They are as different as the cultures in which they were made, and they reflect the particularities of that culture and time. Kind of makes sense, right? So that's William James on that. Second scholar whose work on similarities and differences might be interesting is someone named René Ganon. Ganon was a French intellectual, lived and wrote in the late 1800s till he died in January of 1951. He's an interesting character in terms of his personal story. He's someone that started out down the path of Western philosophy, but changed to the exploration of Islamic philosophy in his mid-30s or so, changed his name and so on. Like, he immersed himself quite deeply in that realm. And he did that because, he said, he found there something universal, something with what he called, it's an interesting choice of phrase from my vantage point, non-human character. So beyond us is the point, right? And when he wrote about religions in general, and I've found this language helpful, you may or may not, but when he wrote about religions in general, he made a distinction between what he called esoteric and exoteric forms. Not everyday words, maybe, but not that hard to understand. The esoteric form of a religion is what we might call its internal form, the experiential core. And as all of these thinkers have pointed out, it's the experiential core that lies at the heart of every religion. often that experiential core to a religion is rooted in the experiences of its founder. And that's maybe easiest to see in stories that we would associate with Buddhism or with Hinduism in terms of religions we might know a little bit more about in the West. In the case of Christianity, this can do with a little parsing. I'm not going to spend any amount of time on this, but some people would regard Jesus as the founder of Christianity. Others would be like, nope, that's just not there in the story at all. This is a rabbi who clearly did not come to found a religion, but to reform the one that he was in, if he was doing anything about the making of religion. But the followers of that teacher had such profound experiences, that's the core, that they made a religion out of it. They founded Christianity. And that's if you read the Christian sacred text, that's the way the story is told there. So that's the esoteric form, this experience that happens, this encounter with mystery, with the sacred, with God, whatever language we want to use for that, and then this thing that gets built up around it. Now, the thing that gets built up around it, that's what Guénon calls the exoteric form. So that's the external forms of religion. That's things like their scriptures, their institutions, their beliefs, all the parts of a religion that we can readily see. It's rather hard to see the other part, right? It's rather hard to see that spiritual experience. We can see what people write about it and what people say about it and so on, but it's not a thing that, it's a thing that we have internally. But this exoteric part, that's the outside, the bit we can see. Like with William James, there's this idea that the core, that the mysterious, what we've sometimes called in this conversation, the mystical core of the major religions is very similar, maybe even identical. But their exoteric forms, those are different. And sometimes they are very different. If you've ever had a deep encounter with another culture, an experience of something being utterly foreign, that's what I'm talking about. I'd made this observation to another group of people recently, kind of illustrating a different point, but this encounter was something different than us. And I'd asked a question of the group, like, how many of you have traveled internationally? And I was kind of thinking that was a benchmark. And then as I was sort of thinking out loud about it, I was like, never mind that. Have you just gone to a different part of your city and turned the corner and gone, I am in it. I recognize the buildings, you know, so maybe not a full immersion in another culture, which includes things like architecture and geography and climate and topography and so on. But we can find ourselves in a space without traveling very far these days where we're like, I don't know how the things work here. That's what I'm talking about, right? So if you ever had an experience like that, that's how different these forms can be. And that level of difference is where the exoteric distinctives of religion comes in. And it runs every bit as deep in the religious realm as it does in any other. So in terms of experience difference, you know, we can just find ourselves in a religious setting where we're like, don't know. What did you say? What did that mean? You know, I don't know. I just don't know. One more thinker to check out here briefly. This person's name is Houston Smith. Contemporary, died in 2016, leading American religion scholar. Smith wrote a book, it's been retitled, it's currently called The World Religions, book about religions that has sold, as of 2017, over 3 million copies, which for a book about world religions is extraordinary. It remains a popular textbook if you're taking a course on like an intro to comparative religions, that kind of thing. Smith, in his work, talks about something he calls the primordial tradition. And he means something along the lines of a tradition going back to the beginnings. It's a little unclear in his work whether he means going back to the beginnings of religious traditions or back to the beginnings of humanity. The word primordial certainly suggests a fairly deep take on how far back. But it's a little bit unclear. But his main point is that primordial traditions go back to a common understanding that underlines all of what he would regard as the enduring religions of the world. And Smith talks about two common understandings that he believes are percolating away underneath all the things that get put on top when we're making religions. And I resonated really deeply personally, with this description of what's kind of chugging along underneath. The first of those common understandings that are perking away underneath all the stuff we put on top of them when we're making religions is a multi-layered understanding of reality. And as soon as I read that phrase, I was like, oh, so not like I'm a material girl living in a material world. Like the next layer, whatever that is, right? Beyond the material. But that was, so help me, that was my pop cultural referent. Just then I couldn't stop it. And then it was stuck in there. And then, you know, I had to go put on some other music to get it, shake it loose. That's the more that William James is talking about, right? That we've also talked about in this conversation as the sacred. In the simplest sort of language, I think it's the belief that in addition to the visible world of our ordinary experience, there are non-material levels of reality. And it's what we're talking about in folk language when we say there's more to this life than meets the eye, you know, and we can toss that one out pretty easily, right? Whenever we're confused or mystified or just kind of like, huh, we can sort of sum it up. That's a multi-layered understanding of reality. And when we're talking about religions as on-ramps to the sacred, which we have, we could just as well say that those practices, those things we call religions, are ways of moving toward a life-altering encounter or a sacred encounter with whatever it is that's more than meets the eye. That kind of an idea. And the second thing that Smith would say makes up the primordial tradition is a multi-layered understanding of the self, body, mind, and spirit. In Smith's work, he finds that understanding at the heart of every one of the religious traditions. I want to acknowledge that all of those thinkers are, among other things, European. So culturally speaking, that's a particular lens. If we were reading thinkers about this from other cultures, which I haven't, but I would be intrigued to see what sorts of thoughts would be there. And if there was common ground in those perspectives. If we pull those together, we find that what religions share in common is this kind of internal core of experience, this encounter with something that is more than meets the eye. So common ground, similarities. When it comes to differences, there are lots of them. And they matter. And this is interesting to me at this moment in this culture where we find ourselves, not least of all because it bumps pretty directly into that whole spiritual but not religious idea. We briefly touched on this earlier, this idea that if all the religions have this internal core in common and it's the external distinctives that get rise to the conflicts, why don't we just ditch the externals? Like, wouldn't that solve a lot of problems? The not religious part of that spiritual but not religious phrase is working with that idea. Religion, in that phrase, could well be thought of as those external, those exoteric parts, things like the institutions, the teachings, the traditions, all that stuff that gives a particular religion its form, its distinctives. And in the saying spiritual but not religious, that stuff is being set up as being in opposition to spirituality, which is what we've been talking about today as being the experiential core, the intrinsic part. And we've considered this before, but to restate it in this context, of course we can be spiritual without being religious. And we can certainly be religious without being spiritual. But what happens to how we see the whole picture if we consider religion as a possible ally of spirituality rather than its adversary or its obstacle? What if religion might be to spirituality what schools, colleges, universities are to higher learning, for instance? You can avoid all institutions of higher learning and still become an educated person. But you're kind of going to have to spend a good chunk of your life reinventing the wheel. And unless you find a way to pass some of that along to the next generations, they're going to have to reinvent it all again as well. It's an interesting perspective. All to say this, if we start with the idea that the core of what prompts us to make religions is something we all have in common, some kind of encounter with more, mystery, love, the sacred, God, then religions can be readily understood as vehicles with the potential to carry us in that direction. Whether they do or not is about practice. It's about how that gets plugged in. But the potential is there. They can be ways in which that mystery can touch us and we can touch it. And if we see them that way, and we believe touching that mystery actually matters, then maybe religions have a place. Maybe they matter. Now, if religion, if religious teachings, religious environments, religious leaders, and so on have been harmful in your life, a couple of further thoughts about this might be especially important. First of all, on a personal note, I want to say that in my experience, at least, you have lots of company. And you have lots of company all around you in this moment and in this culture and around the world. And in light of history, you have lots of company. If we are going to consider that the external forms of religion might actually matter, it is essential that we consider what can happen if they matter too much. This is where things start to go sideways. If the external forms are overemphasized, then being Christian, being Jewish, being Muslim starts to mean believing in this set of values and not that set of values. And the word belief in that sentence is very important. It's not about the presence of those. It's about how they're approached. We might be so used to encountering religions that way, as belief in a certain set of values, that even hearing someone suggest that it could be otherwise might be a little bit startling. It might be kind of like, but that's what religions are. That's why they exist. Is it not? Because that's such a common religious practice, especially if we grew up around Western Christianity, which has become so much about what do you believe. We talked a whole bunch a couple of weeks ago about the possibility of religions functioning as sacraments of the sacred, that they're not actually there to police a set of beliefs, but rather to serve those engaged in those practices by making windows to the mystery. But you have to practice to see through the window, right? Kind of like that. It's not about what you believe. It's about the practices. It's about actually engaging. Anyway, as we've already considered in the history of all the major religions, the emphasis historically has not been on right beliefs. That's a very, very young religious expression. Historically, it's been on the transformation of the human person at the deepest possible levels in the interest of human beings becoming more compassionate. The Buddhist teaching on compassion I find especially fascinating because we tend to think, at least I tend to think, given the influences I grew up with, of compassion as something we practice that way, toward others. And in Buddhist understanding, compassion actually transforms the compassionate one. And yes, it is shared. But there's a mutuality about that, right? If I'm being transformed by being a more compassionate person and you are being transformed by being a more compassionate person, together we more compassionately care for one another and so on. Just kind of flips it around. And that's ancient. So, interesting stuff. When the external forms are absolutized, when things like doctrines and scriptures become what we can see them to be in what we might call religious fundamentalisms, then the inevitable result seems to be religious exclusivism. And religious exclusivism makes religious dialogue impossible. The only end goal is conversion to the only right forms of belief. And when we practice what we practice with the understanding that the only agreed upon end goal is conversion to right forms of belief, some of us don't have to look any further than the home to see how that goes, you know. But if you ever have a moment where you're like, those jihadists, for example, start closer to home, if you will, culturally, you know. That's an expression of exclusivist belief insisted upon by what we sometimes talk about in this space is right-handed power by force. By conversion to that right set of beliefs being the only agreeable outcome to the power holders. So you can sort of see how it goes, how it kind of one piece pushes on the other in that short version. The externals matter, but they matter as relative expressions of the mystery that we all have in common. They matter as on-ramps to the sacred, but not the freeway itself. That we've never had access to manage, determine, finally define, exhaust, whatever language you want to use. The moment we think about that other as something that we define, defend, give other people access to, it's now the same size and shape as us. No longer a mystery with power attached, if you will, but just a complicated idea that we have. There's nothing wrong with a complicated idea that we have. We just shouldn't get it confused with what's sacred. You know? It's pretty important. The idea that we have, if we're interested in touching the sacred, should move us that way. If the ideas that we have do not do that, then they're worth a really good hard look, really careful examination. In terms of, to just circle this back around to that conversation about same but different, the differences are real. Did we ever wonder? They matter. Sometimes we wonder. And it's important that we understand that they need to be kept in their place. They need to not matter too much. They need to not become ultimate and exclusive, which is what happens when we absolutize them. Stay in that space, we can continue in dialogue. We don't have to lose our distinctives. We can hold them and practice them, but we practice them with open minds, open hearts, and open lives, because we know they're not the last word. We know they're things we make, and the things we make change. And if we don't believe the things we make change, we are just being really, really short-sighted, even about our own personal life experiences. You know, this is what happens, right? Things we believe change. And in that space, the world gets bigger and richer, and the possibilities of encountering the sacred multiply. And that seems to me, at least, like that's a good thing. Worth leaning into. All right, going to leave it there for now. And we'll pick it up again next week.